Long ago and far away, there was a teenage boy wandering the farm fields and forests of Ohio. Well, maybe it wasn't that long ago or that far away, but I was a teenage farm boy with a straw hat and bare feet wandering around the fields on the farm in Ohio, and I can tell you that the grass looked a lot greener on the other side of the fence. But when I got there, it turned out to be artificial turf. Part of it did. But anyway, I was on the farm in the summer. The heat would get us. And I thought, wow, if I could only go into the house like one of my friends next door who was not in the Amish church like I was, and he was, as we call him, an English person, and he would come over, and then once in a while, for one reason or another, I'd be able to go to his house. And I got into the house, and it would be 90 outside, and it was 72 in their house. In the wintertime, it was, instead of being 72 outside or 90 outside, it would be 20 outside, and we'd come home, and it was 50 in the house. And we would have to stoke the furnace, fire up the furnace with coal and wood and get it going. And about an hour later, the house would be starting to get warm, up to 60 to 65, and then maybe 70 degrees. Usually one spot was so hot you couldn't stand it, and the other spot was so cold you couldn't be there. But that's the way it was when you fire with wood or when you fire with coal and you don't have forced air and so forth. So I thought how great it would be if I came home. We'd go to church or somewhere, and we'd come home, and it was still warm in the house. It was still 72 degrees, just like it was in the summer when we would get back into the house. And at night, when we'd come home, I thought, how great would it be if we could just hit a switch and lights would come on and we did not have to pump up the Coleman lantern with the clear gas, or the, I guess it's clear gas we used in it, pump it up and then light it and then carry it to another room and light another lamp or lantern and so forth. How great would it be to turn on a switch and this would all just happen? I was not real excited about the lifestyle and the life that I was living. I thought there could be a lot better ways. And I had uncles that were no longer in our faith. When I said our faith, I'm talking about the Amish faith, and they had left, and they had cars, and they had these homes I was talking about and seeing, because once in a while I'd get to go with them and experience all this. But no, not us. We had to live with the slow horse and buggy and all the inconveniences, so to speak, of life. And I just wasn't real excited about that. And at a fairly young age, I realized that I probably wasn't going to live my life that way. But it seemed like forever when you're 14 years old to 19 or 20 or 21 when you get a car and go on your own. Seemed like a long time. But then my dad started talking about possibly us doing something else. He had got some literature, and he started reading it, and he began to realize and understand that the Sabbath, which I thought at first, I'm thinking, you know, what do you mean the Sabbath? What's that? You mean you'd go to church on Saturday? That type of thing. You'd think the Sabbath would be, you know, something strange to us at that point, at that time when you kept Sunday all your life, and many of you have had the same experience in that regard. But he started talking about this, and that maybe we would change our lifestyle and we would start keeping the Sabbath instead of Sunday. At first I thought we were going to be keeping both of them, and thought that, you know, here we are, the one day that I can have some fun on Saturday, because farm work and things to do on Saturdays we usually didn't. Maybe in the morning, the afternoon, we'd be a little more how that was going to be taken away. But as we went along, in the Amish tradition, you only go to church every other Sunday. And that started long ago because horse and buggy and so forth. So they didn't do it every week, just every other week. So in the in-between week, my dad and I would sit at his drop-leaf secretary desk, and we would study the Radio Church of God correspondence course. And I began to see that, yeah, probably the Sabbath should be kept even at 14, 15, 16 years old. I began to realize that, and that maybe we shouldn't have pigs. We sold our pigs off the farm soon after we started farming. That was probably in the late 50s or right around 1960. And then from there, we learned some of these other things. But the point I'm getting at is change our lifestyle, which we did. And I was at the time, I was 19 years old, and I was still a young man. Some of you can relate to this. There was no motivation for me, although I was glad to get out of the drudgery of the farm and so forth. There was no real motivation for me to actually take any further action than that at that time. Then something happened that changed my life, and I'm thinking a few of you in here can relate to this a little bit. I read a booklet that was by that time the worldwide, or the Radio Church of God had become the Worldwide Church of God in the late 60s. And I read a booklet in the early 70s titled 1975 in Prophecy. And I'm betting some of you have read that book. If you hadn't, it's probably still available somewhere. I think I have it somewhere. I haven't seen it for a while, but I'd. And guess what? With Basil Wolverton's pictures in there, with the anxiety on people's faces, with the fear that you could see and all that type of thing, and how it was written with an urgency to it, that booklet scared me to death. I, for the first time, began to think that maybe I should do something. When I say it scared me to death, it literally did in one sense, because it scared me into baptism. And it caused me to take action, because I saw that that is something that I needed in my life and that I should do. But the point that I'm getting at is it caused fear in me. I know that many of you possibly were, maybe some of you did, got involved or interested as a first motivator out of fear yourself. Many people did. And there's nothing wrong with that. But what I want to talk about today is the title of my message is The Fear Factor. And what I want to discuss is how can we overcome, or how can we neutralize fear in our life? How can we overcome, or how can we neutralize fear in our life? Now, fear, again, it's not wrong. It's a feeling or an emotion, or if it is an emotion, which I guess it is, it's something that in many cases, it's a good thing that we have fear, because we fear to put our hand on a hot stove. We fear to get close to the edge of the roof when we're on the roof for fear of falling off. There are many things that fear prompts us to do or motivates us to do that without fear, maybe we wouldn't do it, because young children, they have no fear usually or oftentimes, unless they're trained not to, of running across the road, unless they're told not to and so forth. So I want to talk about neutralizing fear in our life. And again, fear is not wrong. It is just something that has to be controlled. And God's Word has something to say about fear. It has quite a bit to say about fear. There was an incident in the ministry of Jesus Christ in Galilee that addresses this subject a little bit and how we can neutralize it. First, we're going to go to the book of Matthew, if you want to turn there, in the fourth chapter. But in this particular, much of Christ's ministry, or quite a bit of Christ's ministry, was focused in the area or territory of Galilee, if you will. But in the fourth chapter of Matthew, it was foretold that that was would happen. It's actually prophesied that that would happen. We'll start in verse 12. When Jesus heard that John had been put in prison, he departed to Galilee. And leaving Nazareth, which is where he was from, but it looks like he was had been somewhere else. Of course, he had just in the beginning of chapter 4 is when he had been led into the wilderness, as it says, and was tested by Satan. And, of course, he passed that test, and he overcame Satan in that sense on that occasion. And leaving Nazareth, it says in verse 13, he came and dwelt in Capernaum, which is by the sea. That's the Sea of Galilee, in the regions of Zebulun and Naphtali, that it might be fulfilled, which was spoken by Isaiah the prophet, saying, and here it quotes, verse 15 and 16 quotes Isaiah 9, 1 and 2. The land of Zebulun and the land of Naphtali by the way of the sea beyond the Jordan, Galilee, sat in darkness, have seen a great light, and upon those who sat in the light has dawned. So there is a lot of light that he's bringing to Galilee. That was the way it was going to be, and that was the way, really, that it was probably designed to be. But nonetheless, we want to look at some of this light that shone in Galilee. If you have a map, and you didn't know you were going to bring your own props to the message, but if you have a map in the back of your Bible, which many of us do, I do, if you look at the map of the Holy Land in the time of Jesus, or it'll say something like that, or Palestine in the time of Jesus, or something like that, just so that you can follow along a little bit easier, and most Bibles have it, you'll see Galilee is up on towards the top of the map. The Mediterranean Sea is on the left, and then Galilee, and you'll see the Sea of Galilee to the right of the territory, or on the right side I'm not sure if it's in the area of Decapolis or Iturea, but in that area, Samaria, and then Judea. I'm not sure how far exactly it is from Jerusalem to the lower portion of Galilee, but you can see that Nazareth is up there in Galilee, and a number of other towns and some other landmarks that are familiar to us that we've read about in the Bible. Then my Bible has also the 12 tribes where they were settled. If you have that, you'll notice, if you look at that Naphtali and Zebulun sort of in general cover the area of Galilee, and the Sea of Galilee is sort of mostly Naphtali, but it sort of could border almost to Zebulun as well. So anyway, that's where a large focus of Jesus' ministry and many of his miracles and many of his parables and so forth were done, or were spoken of, in the land of Galilee. It's an important area, as it was prophesied to be, in Jesus Christ's ministry. And we want to look at an account from his Galilean ministry that happened on the Sea of Galilee. And there are several that are listed, but we're going to look at one in particular in Mark chapter 4. Mark 4 is where we'll start with this. Jesus, as you know, taught many things in parables. In fact, maybe almost in large part, his ministry consisted of parables in certain areas and at certain times, mostly of parables. And that was, again, by design so that not everybody was going to understand it. He was going to open the eyes of certain people to be able to see it. But this one happened on the Sea of Galilee, which is also called the Sea of Gennesareth, Tiberias, or the Lake of Gennesareth. There are four different names used for the Sea of Galilee, and it's from firsthand accounts. I talked to somebody recently who had just come back from the Middle East, and that's what they said about the Sea of Galilee, that it's not really, wouldn't be considered a sea in this area in terms of size, because next to, what is it, about maybe 20 miles west, where the Mediterranean Sea is, next to the Mediterranean Sea, this is just a little lake. And that's what it was, a little lake. This is where it took place. But the Sea of Galilee is approximately 60 miles north of Jerusalem, as we saw on the map. There are nine villages that bordered the Sea of Galilee, including Capernaum and Bethsaida. The area was known for boat making, fishing, and exporting cured fish, which they cured with some kind of a salt brine or salt. They probably didn't do it as much for local because they probably had fresh fish, but all over that region for a long way, Galilean or the lake of or Sea of Galilee fish was known to be a primary commodity that came from that area. It was apparently a very, very prolific fishing lake. And probably some of us who fish wouldn't mind fishing there someday, and maybe we will in the future. That would be fun. It says, according to Ongar's dictionary, that 18 of Christ's 33 miracles were in the vicinity of the Sea of Galilee, 10 of them right in Capernaum. So it was one of the primary places that Jesus used to have or to do his ministry. It was one of the primary areas, especially in that northern area by the Sea of Galilee. And that area is also where some of his disciples came from, Capernaum and Bethsaida, which was just a little northeast, right on the border of the next province over. So it was a very important part of Jesus Christ's life and ministry. Of course, growing up in Nazareth, a little down further southwest, being his home, it would be. But in Mark 4, in verse, we'll look at verse 1 real quick. But he had been doing a ministry for quite some time, teaching in parables, and you'd have to go back further. In the book of Mark, another chapter back or so, he was healing, he was preaching in parables, teaching, and so forth. But in verse 1 of chapter 4, we see that he's teaching by the sea. And what he did, he said, a great multitude was gathered to him, so that he got into a boat and sat in it on the sea. The whole multitude was on the land facing the sea. So they were sitting in this boat, and apparently it was a pretty good-sized boat, and they were sitting there. The audience was sitting on the hillside above the lake, facing the lake, and he was sitting in a boat to do his teaching from. It probably helped with the acoustics, I'm guessing, because water, obviously, carries sound pretty well. And if everybody is standing around him and he's sitting or most of the teaching was probably done sitting down, but if he was sitting on the ground with them, it would be hard for very many people to hear him. But this probably helped more people to be able to hear. But he was in the boat teaching them. And where we want to get to, though, is in verse 35. When we get to verse 35 of chapter 4, that's where our story really begins. Now remember, he was teaching a lot of parables, and then he had gotten in the boat, he was sitting in the boat, said without a parable, in verse 34, he did not speak to them, and when they were alone, he explained all these things to his disciples, because as I mentioned before, and as we've read many times, not everybody was supposed to hear and understand, or see and understand. But his disciples, his chosen group of people, were supposed to, so he explained it to them. Then in verse 35, says, on the same day when evening had come, he said to them, let us cross over to the other side. Now you can imagine, this was in the evening, that same day, he'd been teaching and speaking all day, and he was probably tired from the long day that he had spent teaching out there on that boat, because he was probably there most of the day, and it would wear you out. It must have been a very calm day, because otherwise, if there had been a lot of commotion, they could not have heard him. So it was probably a calm, quiet, beautiful day that he was sitting on the boat teaching. In that world, in that area, that's how things were done. I'm not sure. I've often wondered, when you get a crowd of like the 5,000 that he fed, which were probably more than that, because I think there were 5,000 men, how do you convey your message, or how do you reach that large of an audience without amplification, which this probably provided amplification, but if the multitudes are as big as it seemed like they were, it would still have been difficult. But Jesus Christ was a man of miracles, and he fed 5,000 with a couple loaves of bread and some fishes, so I'm probably reach most of those people, the ones that had come to hear of teaching. He was in the boat, and he said, let's head for the other side. Now, he would have been on the western side towards the Mediterranean, heading for the east across the lake. And it would have taken probably all night or most of the night to get there, I would imagine. So in verse 36, we see, now when they had left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was. Now, there's some details here that indicate that this was probably a first-hand report of somebody that was probably involved in this. Mark, who is John, the John Mark probably of Acts 12 and other areas in Acts, the indications were that he wasn't here necessarily, he was a reporter. The indications are that he probably got his information from Peter, who certainly could have told him pretty much all the details. I'm guessing that those folks in that time and place were a lot better at remembering details and facts than what we are today, because we obviously can write them down, we can record them. There are all kinds of ways and means that we have to do those kind of things that they did not have in that time period. But nonetheless, this shows in verse 36, the indication is because so many little details that don't necessarily, that aren't real significant to the story, but that still shed some light on things. When they left the multitude, they took him along in the boat as he was. They didn't go back to land. They just turned and headed for the other side. Other little boats were with them also. Then in verse 37 is where it gets critical. It says a great windstorm. Other places, or in some of the when you look up the words or and so forth, it says a furious squall. It was a great windstorm arose, and the waves beat into the boat so that it was already filling. It was getting swamped. It was very much a treacherous trip that they were taking. But that happened all of a sudden. Wouldn't have been that way when they started. Now there's a reason for that. For this furious squall. This lake, the Sea of Galilee, while it's still only a lake and not really a sea as we would say, it's nowhere near even the size of a Lake Erie or anything like that. It's only 13 miles long and 7 miles wide, probably at about the widest points. But it's sitting in a basin with hills surrounding it. And it sort of creates a couple of things. A wind tunnel. This lake, the Sea of Galilee, is the lowest freshwater lake on Earth. It's 680 feet below the Mediterranean, below sea level. And that, because of that, certain things happen at times when warm air and cold air mingle and get together, it causes a lot of turbulence. And that's what starts. And then it becomes like a wind tunnel through there in this basin, and furious squalls will happen. Furious squalls will arise very quickly, and that's what was happening here. This particular place can be as calm as glass one moment, and a few minutes later it can churn up into the kind of squalls that can sink a ship. I don't know if you remember, but you probably do because of the song by, what's his name? He wrote the Edmund Fitzgerald. Gordon Lightfoot. In 1975, in November, the Edmund Fitzgerald, who was a 721 foot long or 729 feet long freighter, Great Lakes freighter, it sunk because of the furious storms that happened on Lake Superior in 1975. All 29 of the people on board perished in a sudden, the squalls of November, it was called, or the storms of November that came through there and sunk this ship. And this ship that Jesus and the disciples were on was much, much, much smaller than that. But it was a big enough ship that it had other little boats around it. And you wonder what, never says in the account of it, but you wonder what happened to the other little boats. Did they make it back to shore, or were they lost in the lake, or what did happen to them? The lake was only 150 feet deep, which is also another reason why the storms would come so violently and so quickly. But you could, if you put yourself, I don't know how many boat trips you've ever taken. I've been on a couple of them that I was a little nervous on. I was on one in Lake Erie. Fortunately, we had a pretty experienced skipper, and he knew pretty much what he was doing. But it was the waves were pretty substantial, and for me, an inexperienced navigator or an inexperienced seafaring person, it caused me some concern. But we made it without incident. But maybe you've been in a boat when there was turbulence off the coast of Florida, the Gulf. We went deep sea fishing one time when we were at the Feast of Tabernacles, and when the waves started coming up, a lot of us got green and sick. It caused a lot of concern there only, or as well. But those were just a couple of the times, and I can understand where somebody would get pretty concerned when they're on a ship of this kind, a small sailing boat as this was, and a furious storm like that would come up. Verse 38, the only person that could really do something the back of the boat sleeping on a pillow. And I think it caused him some consternation, because if you read 38, it says, he, that being Christ, was in the stern asleep on a pillow, and they awoke him and said to him, "Teacher, don't you care? Are you not concerned? Aren't you not worried about us that we are perishing? We're not going to make it. We're going to drown. This is going to be the end of us." They were that concerned about it, and probably they should have been. Fear came into their life. They were afraid. And most of us, probably all of us, would also have been afraid. But he, by the way, the usually supposedly sailing boats like that had a, at that time period, had a like carpeting or something, like carpeting in the back, and a cushions on the seats, and it was reserved mostly for the most prestigious or honored guests or most distinguished people on the ship. They got to sit on the back on the cushions, and that's what he was doing. He probably had taken one of those down and used it for a pillow and started to sleep. And he was probably pretty tired, as mentioned before in the first part of from all his preaching earlier in the day. But they were pretty concerned about it, a lot more than he was. But he rose, said in verse 39, and rebuked the wind and said to the sea, "Peace, be still." And the wind ceased, and there was a great calm. Verse 41 says that they feared exceedingly and said, "Who can this be that even the wind and the sea obey him?" Colossians 1, we'll just keep your finger here, we're coming right back. Colossians 1, verse 15 and 16 and 17. 15, "He is the image of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation." And of course that is talking about Jesus Christ. "For by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on the earth, visible and invisible," like the wind, like the atmosphere, the storms and so forth that are created by that, "whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things, and in him all things consist." And what the word "consist" means is sort of like all things, by him all things hold together. It's by him that everything works. And the indication is that if he let go of it, or if he took a vacation or whatever and went off the job, that things would fall apart. But here, because of that, they consist. So this was the one who made the atmosphere. This was the one who made the elements that cause weather and all the different issues that happened here. This was the one who had made it. Now, when you're doing, and this was a great miracle, and they acknowledged that. And when you're doing something like this, you know, if a person were to heal another person, which nobody can heal except God only, but if somebody was healed, you could sort of justify that, or you could sort of rationalize that. But when you are talking about a non-living entity, like Christ did here with the storm, that's even of a different magnitude almost, because it's not something that you would think could be possible, that you could speak to the wind. Wind can't speak back. Wind is not an animate object. It's inanimate. But he was able to, and that's why they were verse 41, that's why they were so impressed, or so, it said they feared exceedingly, because now they were beginning to see who this was that they were dealing with. They had probably known to some extent before, you know, he had done another thing. He turned water into wine. And that's an inanimate object as well. But a lot of it had to do with healing people. And maybe there were, at times, there were prophets and different examples where people had been affected, or their health, or maybe some healing or so on, possibly. But this was of a different magnitude. In verse 40 is where we wanted to come to. Verse 40 was Jesus Christ's response to them. The response to the conditions and the situation. Verse 40, he said, "Why are you so fearful?" They had not overcome their fears yet. And it's sort of, by the way their question is phrased, it almost seems like he had expected them to be less fearful. But he said, "How is it that you have no faith?" No faith. It was probably, obviously, it was different for him to have faith than it was for them, because of his experience and his knowledge and his the fact that the Holy Spirit was poured out on him without measure and so forth. So it was probably a little easier for him, but nonetheless, he indicated here that they should have had faith by now. How is it that you have no faith? Luke says, and we won't go there, but in Luke 25 it says, "Where is your faith? Where is your faith?" Because they would have expected, after seeing all these miracles that had already been accomplished, probably not all of his miracles that had been accomplished by now, but a lot of them had, and they had seen it. They had, some of them had heard of it before they even saw it, but they did see it. And he expected them to do that. Now, faith can overcome fear. Faith can overcome fear. It can displace fear. It can be the mitigating factor between faith controlling us, or fear controlling us, rather, and allowing faith to take over. The disciples did not have the belief to realize that things would work out. They hadn't maybe quite got the depth of meaning and understanding that Jesus Christ was the Messiah at this point. And they were not going to perish. Jesus Christ was not going to perish. But Jesus Christ clarified this fear factor and faith, and how faith, or how fear rather, can be neutralized in another area of his teaching in Scripture. In Luke, the 12th chapter, this is part of what's called in some circles the traveling section. And what that means is from Luke 9 through Luke 19, it indicates that Christ is making his way from Galilee, from way up there where he had been close to the Sea of Galilee, was making his way on down through Samaria and through Judea all the way to Jerusalem, because he knew his time was coming. It would soon be there. So he was traveling, and but he didn't just go in a straight line. There are indicators throughout this section of Luke. It says as he went, he set his face toward Jerusalem and so forth, because when he came to Samaria, they wouldn't even help him, because he had set his face to go to Jerusalem, and the Samaritans were at odds with the Jews, so they wouldn't even help him. He had sent some emissaries or scouts or people in advance to try and set up places for him to stay and that type of thing, but they wouldn't do it. But in chapter 12 here, in the so-called travel section, in verse 4, he'd been talking about basically the first two or three verses had talked about preaching the gospel in reality. And he said, "And I say to you, my friends, do not be afraid. Don't be afraid of those who kill the body and after that have no more that they can do." pretty easy, or a lot easier from a natural physical standpoint to say or to read off the page here than it is actually to do, because when our life is in jeopardy, fear naturally comes into play. Then verse 6, he said, and he gives a response here. Now, I should mention that neutralize, or what that means, is it means to render ineffective by displacing or replacing. I'll read the definition here rather than quote it wrong. Rendering something ineffective or harmless by applying an opposite force or effect. Again, neutralizing something means rendering something ineffective or harmless by applying an opposite force or effect. And that's what we want to do with fear. We want to render it ineffective by replacing it with something else. Here's what Jesus Christ is saying. He said in verse 6 of Luke 12, "Are not five sparrows sold for 2 copper coins, and not one of them is forgotten before God?" Verse 7, "The very hairs of your head are all numbered," which in some of our cases are getting fewer and fewer. "Do not fear, therefore, you are of more value than many sparrows." He is saying that God knows all of our problems. He knows our fears, or he can. We can go to him to alleviate some of our fears, and we can displace some of those fears with another object or force that will make fears ineffective. It may not replace fears completely, but we can neutralize fear. Verse 22. Then he said to his disciples, he had been talking to, he'd been doing some parables, but then he turned to his disciples and he said to them, "Therefore I say to you, do not worry about your life." And this is a principle that we can keep in mind. You know, sometimes it's what it's talking about is what you'll eat, or what your body, what you're going to wear, and so on, or about the body, what you'll put on, verse 22. But it's the same type of principle in all other areas of life, in displacing or neutralizing fear. Life, he said, is more than food, and the body is more than clothing. "Consider the ravens, for they neither sow nor reap, which have neither storehouse nor barn, and God feeds them. How much more value are you than the birds?" Just like he said about the sparrows. How much more value are we than sparrows? We can render this something which is fear, ineffective or harmless by applying an opposite force or effect. We can displace, we can render it neutralize fear by displacing it with something else, an opposite effect, which is faith, belief in God. And that's what he's getting at here. That's what he's driving at here. Excuse me. He goes on, verse 25, "And which of you by worrying can add 1 cubit to his stature?" We can't increase, you know, we can't stretch and stretch and stretch if we're 5'9" till we're 5'10" or 6 feet. We can't be done. "If you," verse 26, "if you then are not able to do the least, why are we worrying about the rest?" He says, why are we anxious for the rest? 27, "Consider the lilies, how they grow. They neither toil nor spin, and yet I say to you, even Solomon in all his glory was not arrayed like one of these. If then God so clothes the grass, which today is in the field and tomorrow is thrown into the oven, How much more will he clothe you, O you of little faith? We need to replace fear with faith and belief. We need to neutralize fear with faith and belief. And we can do that if we think about what God has done for us and what God can do for us and what God will do for us. He's promised he will. And in many cases, I would venture to say that all of us here that are of the age of cognitive reasoning have had things that you can look back on and say, God took care of me there. God helped me there. God did this for me or that for me. All of us can do that. I know I can in many cases, and probably there are more cases that we don't know about than there are that we do. They're probably behind the scenes. There's more going on to protect us and to watch over us than we even realize. In verse 29, do not seek what you should eat or what you should drink, nor have an anxious mind. And basically, it's not saying that we shouldn't plant a garden or not have a job and not be able to buy food and so forth. That's not what it's indicating. It just tells us, don't be anxious about it. In their society, this would have made even more of an impact than it does in ours, because they don't have the grocery store down the street. They were living pretty hand to mouth for the most part. They might have existed on salted cured fish from the Sea of Galilee for a lot of their existence, along with wild things that were wild. They cultivated things as well, but nonetheless, they had a lot less backup, a lot less support than we do today. So this would have really had an impact on them. It says in verse 30, for all these things the nations of the world seek after, and your Father knows that you need these things. He knows what we need. He knows when we're sick, he knows what we need. We go to get anointed, and we believe that he will heal us because he knows what we need. He knows what's wrong. Verse 31, but seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. And then he clinches it with verse 32. Do not fear, little flock. And we are a little flock, whether it's here or whether it's in the entirety of the church. We are a little flock. For it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. Doesn't mean that things are going to be easy. Doesn't mean that there won't be any setbacks or that there won't be problems. Doesn't mean that at all, but he said it is the ultimate goal is God's kingdom, as he said here in verse 30. Verse 31. Seek the kingdom of God, and all these things shall be added to you. Do not fear, little flock, for it is your Father's good pleasure to give you the kingdom. This is an example that he's showing here of rendering or neutralizing or applying something to render fear ineffective, or to render fear, or to overcome the fear that is in our life by applying an opposite force or effect. Don't worry. On the one hand, fear is here, but don't worry, we'll take care of it. Most of the things we worry about never happen. I read a statistic about that one time, and it's like in the 90% of things that we are all worried about don't happen. Not things happen, bad things happen, but a majority of the day-to-day things that we worry about and are fearful of don't happen. There are times when they do, though. Fear isn't wrong. It's not wrong to be fearful. In fact, it is one of the things that God created in us to protect us. There's, what do they call it? Fright or fight, and that happens. That happens. We immediately. I had an incident one time where I thought a semi was going to hit me in the rear end me in my car, And it didn't happen, but fear was the first impulse I had, fear. But it also, it moved me to action. When I read 1975 in prophecy, it moved me to do something. It motivated me to do something. I got baptized. And that was many years ago, but it didn't mean that things stopped and I had no more trouble. But I learned as I got more experience and as I learned a little bit more of how God helps us, fear decreased. The fear decreased. I still don't want to face things that hurt me. It still frightens me. It frightens me to get too close to the edge of the roof when I'm trying to clean out the gutters. But I know enough because of fear to stay back so I don't fall down on the rocks below. Because I know what would happen then. And it would not be good. It caused the disciples in that boat, caused them to take action as well. They knew where their help was. They may not have had the faith that they could have had or maybe even should have had by that point. But they were like us. But they knew where to go for their help. And that's what they did. Their faith that Jesus Christ could do something about it was rewarded. They were saved. God does not want us to live in fear or to be controlled by fear. Fear is a part of our life, and it should be. But when the storms of life come, we can neutralize fear by replacing it with faith. In closing, I want to keep this in mind. In Psalms, the 34th chapter, it was something David said that he wrote in chapter 34 of Psalms, and it's a oft-quoted and well-written statement. And it's in verse 19 of chapter 34. Chapter 34, verse 19, he says, "Many are the afflictions of the righteous." And this is what we can keep in mind that will help us overcome fear. "Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of all of them." In one way or another, we are delivered because God, it's his pleasure to give us the kingdom.